Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Over the past week, there has been an endless stream of commentaries and reporting about the massacre at Pulse, the popular gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. 49 people, mostly gay Latinos, were killed. It was Latino night. 53 were wounded. In the immediate aftermath of the massacre, the shooter's Muslim heritage shifted media attention to terrorism and ISIS. Since then, angles have also focused on the victims, gay rights issues, gun violence, and mental health. CNN's Anderson Cooper is making headlines for calling out the Attorney General of Florida for backing anti-gay legislation, while at the same time expressing sorrow for the dead. So why isn't this angle getting more attention in our 24/7 news cycle? What stood out for you in the reporting this week? Joining us to discuss coverage are two guests. Mark Stern covers the law and LGBTQ issues for Slate. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you. And we're joined by Sandeep Roy, a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Sandeep's debut novel is Don't Let Him Know. And, of course, Sandeep is the former host of this show, Your Call. And Sandeep joins me in studio. Hi, Sandeep. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be back, Rose.
It's great to see you. So as we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight reporting that stood out this week. So let's start with you, Mark Stern. And what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there's one incredible story and an accompanying video report that I would recommend everyone go out and read and watch. It's by CNN, by a reporter named John Sutter, and it's called I Knew 17 Who Died in Orlando. And it is just a very affecting, beautifully written, painful, but important profile of a man who knew 17 of the victims at Pulse. 17, which is a hugely high number. All of those people are dead now, of course, and the reporting is about his efforts to sort of restore normalcy in his life while remembering and commemorating his friends who have died. And in the midst of all of the takes and partisanship and angles and slants, I thought it was a really important piece of reporting just to focus on the victims and the impact that this massacre has on so many lives.
Wow, that just gives you the chills. I Knew 17 People by John Sutter. You know, we're going to talk about this later in the show, but since you brought this up, Mark, CNN has been specifically focusing on the victims. Anderson Cooper has been live from Orlando all week, and throughout the week, he has made an effort to really talk about the victims and interview their family members.
Yes, that's absolutely right, and I think it's really commendable on his part. He has proved himself to be a very, very strong reporter in the wake of tragedies. Sadly, a necessary qualification for any national reporter in the United States these days. But he immediately focused right in on the victims, on their families. He very memorably read out each victim's name, showed as many pictures as he could, and said one or two just small human facts about them, which was, I thought, one of the truly great moments of coverage. Not great in the sense that it was, you know, easy to watch in any sense, but great in the sense that it had to be done. It was very important. And so, yes, I think Cooper deserves all of the praise and the credit that he's getting right now, because his reporting is really some of the best out there.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the attention that Anderson Cooper is getting for interviewing the Attorney General of Florida and calling her out on live television, Florida's Attorney General Pam Bondi, and saying, I will say I've never really seen you talk about gays and lesbians and transgender people in a positive way until now. And now she's going on other media outlets and complaining about that interview. So we'll talk about that later in the show. So thanks for that one. Again, kudos to John Sutter, who's a columnist for CNN. He wrote a piece, I Knew 17 Who Died in Orlando. And that's Mark Stern. He covers the law and LGBTQ issues for Slate. And what about you, Sandeep? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, since I'm back in the studio after a long time, I take the liberty of nominating two pieces. They're both about Orlando, but very, very different pieces. One was in the New Republic, where Lisa Wade wrote this piece where she was tying in both the Stanford rape story and Orlando, and did this really interesting take on what it says about American ideas of masculinity. Mm. You know, both stories, which in a way, the Orlando story pushed the Stanford rape story out of the headlines. But she was saying that they both are tied to these rigid ideas of masculinity that different about differentiating real men from women, and by extension from gay and bisexual men, you know, and then as more has been coming out about the killer, about whether he was a conflicted gay man or not, these ideas of, you know, men and aggression and how they act out. And she points out that, you know, on all these sort of killings that you've seen over and over again, it's men who do it. And so it's a very interesting comment on, you know, what it says about American masculinity. And on another note, the essayist Richard Rodriguez wrote a piece in the LA Times where he talked to it. This was right after Orlando happened. And he talks about the something he's written about often, the desert religions and their ideas of around homosexuality. So not just Islam, but he talks about the person who stabbed people at the gay pride parade in Israel, the person who was trying to take bombs or guns to the LA pride. And he says, you know, hate, this one line I remember where he says, hate comes too often are the product of religions affronted by love.
Hmm.
And it was a, you know, that line really stuck with me. And it's a really interesting way to look at it.
Hmm. So kudos to Lisa Wade of The New Republic for writing about masculinity. And then Richard Rodriguez writing in the LA Times. This sounds really interesting, especially as the coverage shifted almost immediately to the Muslim, the shooter's Muslim heritage. And then it was all about terrorism and ISIS.
Yeah, and you know, and where, I mean, it did, because predictably we were in the middle of this presidential election, so it fit neatly in with Donald Trump. And so, the you know, the irony of Donald Trump suddenly positioning himself as the savior of lesbians and gays and bisexual and transgender people. And I mean, it really struck me the irony of the fact that this man who has made his campaign, started off his campaign by demonizing Latino immigrants, and definitely no friend of gays and lesbians, you know, in around same-sex marriage and all of these issues, is suddenly positioning himself as the savior of what is basically dead Latino gay men. And you know, and then from this, Donald Trump is becoming the savior. And that struck me, you know, there was almost, I hate to use the word relief, but the fact that you could pinpoint that, oh, this is the Muslim person who has done this, allowed people to shape the narrative in the way they wanted to do it. And, you know, when Donald Trump says, this proves that we shouldn't be letting these people into the country, even though, of course, this guy was born in Queens. You know, nobody says in all the other school shootings and massacres, you know, nobody's saying, let's not let white people into the country. I mean, if you're going to make that kind of logical leap.
Sandeep Roy is a commentator on NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. His debut novel is called Don't Let Him Go. He's the former host. Don't Let Him Know. He's the former host of Your Call, co-host. And we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. So as is always the case now in our 24/7 media world, the commentaries come out immediately. The articles come out immediately, even though we don't have the facts. And because of social media, everybody now has an opinion. And so it's so overwhelming for the average person to sift through all of this and find the truth. Mark Stern, just generally, when you look back at how this story unfolded and was reported, what really stood out for you?
Well, one thing that stood out was that the immediate reports completely elided the fact that this was an LGBT club, which I found very strange. I think when a massacre occurs at a church or in a school or any other place where it seems that the victims might have been targeted because they were there, that fact is always in the early reports. And yet the news alerts that most people were getting throughout Sunday morning and into early afternoon failed to mention anything about the fact that this was an attack on an LGBT club, a gay club, on Latino night at that. And so I was disappointed in that early coverage. I don't know why it occurred, but it was remedied fairly quickly by most major outlets. We did see the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and Time trying to get it right. And even better, we saw NPR actually put a disclaimer at the bottom of its story saying, this is a breaking news report. Some of what we say now will be wrong, and we apologize. We're trying our best. I thought that was really important. I think that should be standard operating procedure for any outlet that covers breaking news, because people have a tendency to take whatever they read, especially in those early moments, as fact and cling to it and stick with it. And so often those early facts, quote unquote, turn out to be completely untrue. So on the whole, I do think the media did a commendable job in covering this and in the early hours of confusion. But their willingness to leave out some of these critical facts did strike me as a little odd.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. I mean, Sandeep, we live in a different media world now, and everybody wants to be first with the information, whether it's accurate or not. How do you think the media should deal with this? And it's interesting to hear about NPR's disclaimer.
Yeah, I noticed that, actually. And as somebody who writes for various outlets, I feel that pressure, too. You know, so I was here in San Francisco when it happened, and some of the places that I write for in India just say, oh, can you write something? Can you write anything? And then, you know, and then you do feel that pressure to have a take on it, and you hone in on one little aspect. But as Mark said, one of the pieces I wrote, in fact, talked about the pink elephant in the room, as it were, where some media, world leaders, the Indian Prime Minister, for example, were trying to walk this fine balance of condemning the violence without condoning the lie. They wouldn't mention the G word. And I said, you know, the least that you can... These people were targeted because they were in an LGBT nightclub. The least that you can do is, you know, they are dead now. You know, let's bury them in coffins, not in closets. And this was, but it was striking, as I was saying before, to see the New York Times and see the cover, all the pictures of the people who died, and realize that probably in the history of the newspaper, so many brown gay people have not appeared above the main fold of the paper ever. Mm-hmm. And it was, honestly, initially, I was really numb by it. I didn't know what to say. I mean, what do you say when confronted with such horrendous tragedy? But it was only when those stories of the people who died started coming out that, you know, something unknotted inside you, and you actually felt the depth of the tragedy when you heard about the mother who would go to that club to dance with her son. And she dies.
And she dies
in that club. You know, that's when you feel the real tragedy. Or those two young men, Ramon Guerrero and his boyfriend, and how he had been scared to tell his parents. He's 23. He's going to turn 23, and how he had been scared to tell his parents about that he was gay. But he did, and they accepted him. And Time magazine interviewed the father, who said, you know, he wants them to have their funeral services together.
Wow.
You know, and he says, I don't care what people think. That's what he would have wanted. You know, that's when you realize the impact of these stories. And it also made me think, I wonder how many people got outed by dying.
I was thinking about that, too. Mark, what are your thoughts on this? The Washington Post had a piece about how the Democrats in their tweets talked about how this is so horrific for the LGBTQ community, especially during Pride Month. And the Republicans did not mention it, like Sandeep just said. And one of the first pieces you wrote was called Republicans Are Erasing LGBTQ People from Their Own Tragedy.
Yes, I mean, just to continue on what was aptly described as the pink elephant in the room, I think it was unsurprising to see Republicans not even note the fact that this was a crime against LGBT people, because, well, first, in those early moments, it wasn't quite clear who committed it, what his motivation was, and I think there would have been a huge political reckoning that we have not seen had it been a conservative Christian, a deranged conservative Christian, rather than a deranged radical Islamic extremist. You know, we would be having a very different conversation right now. So to some extent, I think Republicans were hedging their bets. To another extent, I think they just don't ever want to humanize the LGBT community more than absolutely necessary. I mean, this is a party that still has in its platform that gay people are not not deserving of any civil rights, and state Republican Party platforms still encourage conversion therapy for gay people. So this is a very reactionary party on the topic of gay rights, and I think, on the whole, the party and individual politicians just strongly resist ever lending outward sympathy to the LGBT community, or more importantly, ever acknowledging that LGBT people remain vulnerable in America. The entire political talking point right now is that LGBT people are extremely powerful and have special interests and are trying to ram, for instance, same-sex marriage down the throats of people across the country who don't want it. And so, you know, acknowledging the fact that this did target LGBT people, that we are still vulnerable in many ways, would kind of ruin or at least disrupt that talking point.
And Republicans in Florida went on national television on the first day to condemn the shooting. Marco Rubio went so far as to specifically blame the shooter and ISIS, explicit hatred toward gay people for the massacre. But just a couple of months ago, Marco Rubio announced an anti-LGBTQ marriage and family advisory board, quote unquote, comprised of anti-gay activists to combat the growing rights available to the LGBTQ community nationwide.
Yes. That's exactly right, and that just sort of hints at the hypocrisy here of the conservative politicians who allege to feel incredibly bad about this and yet continue to fight behind the closed doors to revoke all LGBT people's rights. Again, it's not surprising, but it is where we are right now, and I think it's very important for the media to continue reporting on it, to continue reporting on conservative politicians' resistance to acknowledge that this was an attack on LGBT people and on our community.
The Indian Prime Minister was one of the first people who were leaders who issued a tweet condemning this violence. And he said, you know, the thoughts and prayers are with this. And he got a lot of pushback in India because in India, gay rights, you know, sodomy is criminalized. And so the government has not been in support largely of repealing that. And so he got a lot of pushback saying, you know, this is hypocritical. Here you are condemning this over there. Well, whereas back home, you're supporting the criminalization of homosexuality. And there is a point there. However, I would also make the point that even if he supports the or doesn't support the repeal of these laws, you're still allowed to condemn the violence that happened. Mm-hmm. You know, as a friend was mentioning yesterday, you know, I may abhor everything that the KKK stands for, but if there's a KKK rally and, you know, 50 people there get mowed down, I will still condemn the violence. So they're not entirely incongruous, but I think people should definitely be called out on it, as Anderson Cooper saying, is like, okay, so are you just, so when some of these leaders say that, you know, this is not about gay and lesbian, this is about humans, we are, you know, this is about humanity. And I'm like, don't let your concern for humanity suddenly become a way to erase somebody's gay identity, because that's essentially what these people are doing that.
So as you mentioned, and we've been talking about this, CNN's Anderson Cooper is actually making headlines. The New York Times wrote a piece about this. Here and Now, which airs on NPR, is talking about this. He made headlines after he challenged Florida's Attorney General Pam Bondi. And CNN's Anderson Cooper has been in Orlando all week doing live coverage. And here's a clip from that live interview.
I saw you the other day saying that anyone who attacks the LGBT community, our LGBT community, you said, will be gone after with the full extent
of
the
law.
That's
exactly right.
I talked to a lot of gay and lesbian people here yesterday who are not fans of yours and who said that they thought you were being a hypocrite, that you for years have fought, you've basically gone after gay people, said that in court that gay people, simply by fighting for marriage equality, were trying to do harm to the people of Florida, to induce public harm, I believe was the term you used in court. Do you really think you're a champion of the gay community?
Let me tell you, when I was sworn in as Attorney General, I put my hand on a Bible and was sworn to uphold the Constitution of the state of Florida. That's not a law. That was voted into our state constitution by the voters of Florida. That's what I was defending. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do. I've never said I don't like gay people. That's
ridiculous.
But you
do say. But do you worry about using language accusing gay people of trying to do harm to the people of Florida? When doesn't that send a message to some people who might have bad ideas
Anderson,
in mind?
Anderson, I don't believe gay people could do harm to the state of Florida.
But you argued that in court.
My lawyer argued a case defending what the Supreme Court allowed the voters to put in our state constitution.
But you are arguing that gay marriage, if there was gay marriage, if there was same-sex marriage, that would do harm to the people of Florida, since Florida society.
That it was constitutional to put that in this. In the Constitution.
Are you saying you did not believe it would do harm to Florida?
Of course not. Of course not. Gay people. No, I've never said that. Those words have never come out of my mouth.
But that is specifically what you were arguing in court.
And that is a clip of CNN's Anderson Cooper challenging Florida's Attorney General Pam Bondi. When I first saw this, Sandeep, the first question was, why is this making headlines? Why are so many people talking about it? It's because it rarely happens.
Yeah.
Why?
It rarely happens because I think for a lot of people, you know, it is about access to politicians and stuff. So you don't want to cross a certain line and thereby have the axe fall on, or, you know, people, which Donald Trump is doing all the time with everybody that he doesn't like. It's like, no more access, no more access. You can't be. But I think also definitely the story here also is Anderson Cooper's own sexuality, which should not be the story at all. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, oh, you know, the assumption is that because Anderson Cooper is gay, he is speaking up this strongly for gay rights, when really Anderson Cooper is doing his job by using the statements that Pam Bondi has made and asking her, well, how does this line up with what you're saying right now? But I think it's like completely ridiculous and unfair to sort of imply that, you know, in a way it would encourage people to stay in the closet. Basically, if Anderson Cooper had never, you know, come out or been public about his sexuality, then this would have been less of a news item. But I think it is kind of, it's absolutely, but it happens all the time. I mean, as I was saying, the San Francisco Chronicle took a reporter who was lesbian off the marriage story when first Gavin Newsom was doing the marriages in City Hall. Mm. I mean, they thought of it as a conflict of interest, whereas, you know, white people can report on anything in the world, presidents, prime ministers, economy, without it ever being a conflict of interest.
Well, what about that, Mark? Here and Now, a show that airs on NPR, the hosts Robin Young and Jeremy Hobson spoke with David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, about coverage. And they said that Anderson Cooper could have allowed Pam Bondi to express her emotions without being overrun with, quote, accusations. And then all three of them were discussing whether Anderson Cooper's sexual orientation gives his reporting a bias.
Well, I think even the discussion that his sexual orientation gives his reporting a bias is incredibly unfair and prejudiced on its face. I don't think that is a rational discussion for any of us to have. I think if you want to attack someone's reporting, you do it on the merits. You don't attack them because of their race or because of their sex or their sexual orientation. So I think that conversation has no place here. I will say that I dissent from the general progressive praise that has been heaped on Cooper for that specific encounter. I think the rest of his reporting was excellent, but I think there is a difference between confronting a politician like Marco Rubio, who is voluntarily out there spreading vehemently anti-gay, homophobic, transphobic rhetoric, contributing to fomenting anti-gay hate and creating an atmosphere where anti-gay violence might be acceptable, and Pam Bondi, who is an attorney general and is actually required to defend and uphold the state's laws. Now, Marco Rubio is a politician. He gets to do and say whatever he wants. Pam Bondi as Attorney General, and when she was serving in 2013 and 2014 when this lawsuit arose, she did have a duty to defend Florida's same-sex marriage ban. Now, we can have a conversation about whether she did so too vigorously, whether some of the language in her briefs was insulting, which I think it was, and most importantly, whether she failed to comply with the Supreme Court's order quickly enough. The short version is she did not at all. She led Florida in dragging its feet to comply with the Supreme Court's order on same-sex marriage. I think those would be fair points to attack her on. But simply defending Florida's ban, no. I think that's a terrible precedent for progressives to send and to create. I think that we should really not be vilifying attorneys general simply for doing what their job requires them to do.
Well, we'll get a response from Sandeep after the break, and I'd love to also hear you, Mark, talk about why this doesn't happen more often. For example, why aren't reporters asking Marco Rubio about what you just brought up, about his record? Mark Stern covers the law and LGBTQ issues for Slate, and Sandeep Roy is a commentator on NPR's Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and the former co-host of Your Call. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio, which is better when you participate. Call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Call because Eric Ivan Ortiz Rivera, 36 years old, can't make that call right now. Call because Enrique Rios Jr., 25 years old, won't be picking up his cell phone soon. You can email feedback at yourcallradio.org because Christopher Joseph San Felice, 24 years old, can't do that. Feedback at yourcallradio.org because the parents of Jason Benjamin Josephit, 19 years old, probably has something a little bit more pressing to do right now. The number again, 866-798-8255.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today it is our media roundtable. We are talking about media coverage of the massacre at Pulse, a popular gay nightclub in Orlando. 49 people, mostly gay Latinos, were killed. 53 were wounded. And in the aftermath of this massacre, the shooter's Muslim heritage shifted a lot of the attention to terrorism and ISIS. Since then, there's been so many angles. What are your thoughts on the reporting on this massacre? What really stood out for you? What shined? What do you think is missing? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Mark Stern. He covers the law and LGBTQ issues for Slate. And Sandeep Roy is a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Sandeep's debut novel is called Don't Let Him Know. Sandeep is also former co-host of this show, Your Call. Sandeep, what are your thoughts on what Mark said before the break? I mean, he said, I think the reason why this Anderson Cooper interview is getting so much attention and a lot of praise on the progressive side is because it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, I think Mark obviously has a valid point about, you know, what somebody is constitutionally obliged to do versus what's in their heart and versus, you know, what the politician is saying and should be. I mean, if Rubio or other politicians were routinely challenged on stances that they had taken, then this story would obviously be like a blip. And most people don't know who the Attorney General of Florida is, you know, so it would make much less news if somebody like a senator or a governor from that state was given that kind of access or grilled or, you know, challenged, basically. And I think it's because, but I think the story is becoming, in some ways, what Anderson Cooper should have asked or should not have asked or, you know, did he was right, is actually the side story. It's being sometimes propped up as the main story because the understory, which is the main story, is about his sexuality. If it had been a different reporter doing it, people would have said, oh, he got a little, you know, overboard in doing that. I mean, you could also, I mean, I'm sure if Anderson Cooper had been interviewing someone from the NRA, and challenging them on these issues, it wouldn't have got quite, you know, as much. It's because he was specifically talking about the gay issue that it caught people's attention.
We have an email from Ruby who says, you know, the only way you get diversity in thought is to have diversity on your board, your sports team, journalists on the job. Of course, you need integrity, courage, and honesty. I guess he was angry, and that wasn't professional. But why aren't more people asking these hard questions? Because it doesn't personally hit them in the guts, maybe? I'm glad you're asking these questions, writes Ruby. I don't know the answers, but I want diversity everywhere. We're a diverse nation, and I expect to be educated as well as informed by those who are unlike me.
Yeah, and I mean, this story of what happened in Orlando, I mean, how even when you're talking about the LGBT issues and LGBT press, how often do you see Latino voices in that story? If you're talking about Latino voices in America, it's invariably a story about immigration.
Exactly.
You know, that is when, as reporters, we reach into our Rolodex and call Latino commentators and we bring them onto shows to talk about immigration. When you're talking about doing a show on gay and lesbian issues, how often, if it has not directly affected Latinos as it has done in Orlando, do you go out of your way to get a gay Latino person or a black lesbian onto the show, not for what they have to say about the issue, not just because you're trying to tick off a diversity calendar?
Mm. Mark, what would you add?
I think that's a really, really terrific point. I think there is a real problem just within the LGBT establishment, you might call it, of diversity that we've known about for a really long time. It cannot be denied that right now many of the leaders of the LGBT movement are white. Most of them are men. And so, like so many other movements in America, the gay rights movement does have a white male problem. And so it was startling, in a very good way in some sense, to see so many gay Latino voices come out of the woodwork and be given huge spotlights and microphones, outlets like the Washington Post and the New York Times, to write about this issue and to cover it from that perspective, from a diverse perspective, a more informed and enlightened perspective. Obviously, this, you know, one small thing cannot outweigh the incredible tragedy of what happened in Orlando, but it is a remarkable moment for this movement, because it reminds everyone, hey, gay rights are not just about the Human Rights Campaign and Jim Obergefell. That stuff is great, but there is this entire community of minority gay people who do not usually have a voice, and they need to be part of this conversation at all times, not just at times like this.
You know, yesterday I was actually at the opening film of the San Francisco Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, and the opening film is a documentary called Kiki, and it's about these young, mostly African-American young people who are in New York and Harlem and areas like that, and dealing with homelessness, and it's a bit like Paris is Burning, you know, and they get into dance and voguing as a way to find community together. And there, this very remarkable transgender person, this young woman, says, you know, yeah, marriage equality, you know, that's an issue for Chelsea. That's why all the people in Chelsea got very happy about marriage equality. I got things to deal with in terms of, you know, substance abuse, homelessness, people being kicked out of homes. You know, the LGBT movement did not end with winning marriage equality. There's a whole lot of issues that are still out there to fight. And one of the other things, I mean, as Mark said, you saw Latino voices as a result of this. But the other thing you also saw was you saw gay or queer Muslim voices finally in the issue. And, you know, these are people who are lost in the story. You know, they are sort of getting it from both sides in this story, you know, and to hear their perspective has been remarkable. Mm-hmm. And even those, you know, some of the people who went on national shows had a really hard time because as a queer Muslim, they were sort of thrust into the show and required in a way to defend their religion, you know, saying like, is it true that Islam is this, Islam is that? And, you know, and as it is, as a queer person, you're marginalized in both of these things. And then to be, you know, to be played homophobic things that some imam has said somewhere and say, well, how do you defend that? You know, you don't always get that for, say, Christian gay activist brought on, you know, is not asked to defend what Pat Robertson is saying.
Hmm. And that's what Sandeep wrote about in one of his latest pieces. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Sandeep is former co-host of this show. He's a commentator on NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You can also hear his dispatches from Kolkata on KALW. And check out his debut novel, Don't Let Him Know. Mark Stern covers the law and LGBTQ issues for Slate. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. Thank you. I fully support Anderson's, Cooper's, taking the Attorney General to task on his gay rights supports. But I do believe that saying that journalists aren't biased when it comes to their identities, whether that's gender identification or ethnicity, is naive. I'm a woman of English-American ancestry, and if I were a powerful enough journalist, I think that the examples that I would give and the stories I might reference might touch upon my cultural and gender background. I might even choose stories or interviews, from time to time that actually touched upon those identities. And I just wanted to make that point.
Well, it's a great point. That's why we need diversity in the newsroom. We all bring different experiences to the table.
Yeah, and hopefully your experiences enrich the conversation as opposed to ghettoize the conversation that, you get to cover this issue because you are gay or you're Indian or you're Latino and things like that. And I think it's sort of like you should see your heritage as an asset and not a bias. It means you might bring something more to the conversation.
Yes, I completely agree. And I understand what the caller is speaking to, the fact that there may be some a kind of bias on the part of all of us, given our backgrounds and our heritages. But I think for diversity purposes, it's better not to think of that as bias, as just sort of diversity, enlightenment, speaking from experience. You know, Anderson Cooper did not necessarily have a bias because he was gay. He simply had a better understanding of why gay people in Florida might be outraged to see Bondi speaking on behalf of the gay community after attacking them for so long. So, you know, to me, that's not a form of bias. It's just a deeper understanding, an intuitive knowledge of the issues that matter to the community at that time.
And Shane writes, a question for those who've criticized Anderson Cooper about his sexuality influencing his reporting. How much does your sexuality influence your opinion about this? The unchecked heterosexual privilege here by those who question Anderson just because he's gay has to do with these people never having to wonder whether their own sexuality is influencing their reporting. Our culture just assumes the perspective of the straight white man. Sean says, it's disingenuous of Here and Now to frame Anderson Cooper's sexuality as a conflict of interest. He says that there's a lot of a tradition of NPR pigeonholing its own reporters based on gender, race, ethnicity, national origin, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point about the invisibility of heterosexuality today. We always hear about homosexuality. We always hear about gay people, potential biases, that kind of thing. We never hear about the biases of heterosexual people, how being straight might affect your reportage, simply because straight people are in the majority and likely always will be. So I think it is important to, whenever you're talking about some kind of issue that someone being gay might raise, you should flip that, and you should always think, well, would I be saying the same thing if it were a straight person in an analogous position? Would I question whether his or her heterosexuality is influencing his or her reportage? And if the answer is no, then your idea and your suspicion is probably unfounded.
And Sandeep, I don't want the whole conversation just to focus on that, because Fusion had a great piece, a very important piece. It's called It's Still Dangerous to Be Gay in America. Here are the stats that prove it. They point out that according to the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs, data suggests 20 to 25% of the LGBTQ community experience hate crimes within their lifetimes. That's a massive number.
Yeah.
Are you seeing this in the reporting?
No, because I think a little bit of what's out there, some of the outrage is, so when a Donald Trump comes and says, you know, Hillary Clinton wants to let people like this into this country who would want to execute gays, he is basically also buying into or feeding this narrative that America is this safe, sanctuary place. You know, maybe he doesn't want those gays to have same-sex marriage or marriage equality or things like that. But, you know, it's still a safe space. Whereas in reality, most places, you know, irrespective of where the laws are, of course, people, a lot of people come and see gay people seek asylum in America because they're coming from places where it is actually punishable by death. But that's not a basis for comparison where you say like, oh, I mean, you would get this all the time. I would get friends who would be, if they were gay and they said something about, you know, this issue in America is anti-gay, they would be told, well, you can just go back to Pakistan or you can just go back to Iran. And the fact that, oh, because I come from a country where I might be executed or stoned to death or because I am gay, therefore I must keep my mouth shut about anything that I perceive as anti-gay or anti, you know, anything in this country. Really, it's not an argument at all. It's actually a way to shut down an argument rather than expend. And this is where the whole whataboutery begins, you know, where you say like, oh, you're so outraged about this issue. What about that issue?
Right. Also, what about reporting about the fact that words have consequences? Legislation like these bathroom laws have consequences, Mark, at a time when homicides against the LGBTQ community have surged since 2007 and queer people of color are especially at risk. How do you, as a reporter, go about really tackling these issues?
Well, there's an even more poignant irony there that I think reporters should generally know when they are talking about bathroom bills, which are laws like we've seen in North Carolina that exclude transgender people from using the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity. And that is that trans people face an immense amount of violence against them in bathrooms. There is a huge problem of trans people simply attempting to use the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity and getting beaten up or violently assaulted or even killed simply because they dared to use the correct bathroom. And so, you know, obviously that doesn't tell the whole story, but it's a way of balancing out the issue within the report a little bit. You know, if you just read the news casually and you kept reading all of these reports about bathroom bills, you might start to wonder, well, why is this such a big deal to trans people? You might wonder, why don't they just use unisex bathrooms or just use the bathroom at home? And you don't understand the incredibly pressing need on the other side of this issue to better incorporate trans people into society at large and to promote tolerance toward trans people, because they are getting killed. They are getting beaten up. There is immense violence against them. And, you know, I think you said it really well. Words have consequences. Legislation has consequences. Legislation like North Carolina's is largely symbolic. The North Carolina bathroom bill didn't even have an enforcement mechanism. This was not carefully thought through. This was a symbolic piece of legislation designed to tell all trans people that they were second-class citizens and designed to tell the rest of the state in North Carolina that trans people did not deserve full and equal rights. So that kind of stuff, I mean, it might seem minor, but it really does echo and resonate across society in some very dark ways.
I was going to mention an ironic twist in India, where I'm living right now. It's actually trans people who have been able to get more rights and equality from the state and the court than gays and lesbians. And, you know, the same Supreme Court that ruled against gays when it came to sex against the order of nature, as they call it, actually ruled in favor of trans peoples in terms of rights, in terms of, you know, education, access, like treating them as a minority. And that is partly because, as Mark said, they have also, the trans people have borne the brunt of attacks, being visible, whereas gay people in a way could pass in a certain way. And therefore they've been a more of an invisible minority in the country, as the court called it, a minuscule minority. And so in a sense, trans people have always been at the forefront of this issue. You know, but this was true in America, it's also true in India.
We have a tweet from a listener who says, like they care, referring to politicians who are passing anti-gay legislation. They're working to put LGBT people back in the closet. Thanks for that tweet. You can tweet us at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to another caller, Liz in Alameda. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. The point I would like to make is that this young man was a person who is very conflicted about his homosexuality. And I feel that he has used the connection to ISIS as a means to an end. And I'd like to see more reporting on this particular issue. Thank you.
Thank you. We have sort of a related question from Mark, who says, do your guests have any knowledge of the shooter's actual affiliation concerning radical Islamic groups? I have heard that over time he professed allegiance to Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda before he claimed to be inspired by ISIS.
Yes, which Mark. Would be, of course, conflicting allegiances. And that really goes to the broader issue here. This man did not appear to coordinate closely with any kind of terrorist group. This man seemed to be a lone wolf in every sense of the term. He had a computer, he had the internet, and he lived in the United States where he could buy a weapon of war very easily, and that was all he needed. It does seem increasingly like the fact that he shouted things about ISIS as he was committing the killings were not any kind of signifier that he was doing so on behalf of the group or at their request. But I also wanted to speak to something that the first caller said about the fact that the shooter may or may not have been closeted. You know, this sounds very strange when you first hear it, but it makes sense. A lot of anti-gay hate crimes are committed by closeted gay people or people who identify as straight but also have sex with people of the same sex, and they're almost always men. And the reason seems to be that these people have intense internalized homophobia. They are incredibly conflicted about the sort of gap between how they feel they should be and who they feel they should be and who they are in real life. And they end up resolving this dissonance in a violent way against people who are able to fully express their identity and live out their lives truthfully. And so it sounds very twisted, and it might sound like a little bit of a Freudian analysis, but in the end, there is a very clear pattern here. And so if it does turn out to be indisputably true that the shooter was closeted, I wouldn't be surprised at all, and really none of us should be surprised, because this is a pattern in the realm of anti-gay hate crimes.
That's sort of what Lisa Wade was talking about in the New Republic story I mentioned in the beginning. So it wouldn't be surprising. And also, when you read the interviews that the father has given, you can realize that a lot of the conflict probably also stems from the father's, the family dynamics that were at play there. You know, this father is a very interesting and strange character, but at the same time, you know, I don't want to jump into conclusion. I mean, he's dead. I mean, at the end of it, we don't know what terrible. You know that there was something terribly knotted and wrong inside him. And you will probably never know exactly as to, you know, because this is a spectrum, how closeted he was or not. We may never know. So we'll be left guessing. All, you know, in the sense, what we are trying to do, I mean, this is tragedy so senseless and brutal that in the end, we are trying to apply rational things to try and make some sort of logical sense out of the tragedy. And at some level, it exists in the realm of the illogical.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for the email. Thank you for the call. Let's go next to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to take this in a slightly different direction about the media coverage of such incidents, such violent incidents, irrespective of the specifics of who the victims were, that the relentless media coverage of these kinds of incidents and the easy labeling of, with this word terrorist, which what does that even mean? It gets thrown on there. That this tends to provide a great amount of publicity for a person who does such a thing, and that would increase the possibility or the likelihood of someone else doing such a thing. That's the question.
Yeah, apparently the guy was, when they checked his phone, they saw he was checking to see if Pulse shooting was trending on Facebook right. While the standoff was continuing. So, yes, that's absolutely a part of it.
Hmm. Yes, and it's something we've seen over and over again, that these deranged gunmen tend to desire, even crave publicity, even when they know that they're going to die at the end of it. They'll never be able to reap the sort of sick rewards. But, you know, there are rules that the media can follow and can follow better. For instance, trying to minimize the amount that we name the gunman or use the gunman's picture when he is not at the center of the story. But the problem here strikes me as a somewhat intractable respectable one, because, you know, we can either cover massacres as huge news, I believe they are, and I think most Americans believe they are, or we can try to sort of downplay them in an attempt to prevent the cycle from continuing. I think we just don't have enough facts about the effectiveness of the latter strategy to do that yet. And even more so, I think if the media did try, it would be insulting to the survivors and to their families to see this horrible thing fade from the headlines just because we have a suspicion that accurate and continual coverage could create another event.
Yeah, and then people would say, this has been downplayed because it was in a gay nightclub. I mean,
yes, that's exactly right.
You'd hear that immediately.
We have time for one more caller. Thank you, Mark. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa.
Yeah, thanks for covering this and all your LGBT coverage this week. I just wanted to maybe disagree with Sandeep and say I don't think we should look at this as senseless. I think that makes him into a freak and doesn't help us to understand the racism, sexism, homophobia that creates this and the militaristic society we live in. I mean, that's the same way mainstream media covers rape. They see it as an individual case, whereas we live in a rape culture. I think it's really problematic when we look at it that way. As you said, Sandeep, he's dead, so we don't actually know him, so I think it'd be unfair to actually put that on him. I think the act is obviously horrible, and I think it's important that we remember that and not to excuse what happened, but to better understand it. Mm.
No, I agree with that. When I use the word senseless, it means it is something that is so hard for us to make sense of, because you wake up and you see this news, like somebody has gone into a nightclub and just decided to mow people down. It's senseless in that from the viewer perspective, in a way. But obviously, there are many forces at play that would drive someone to that point.
Well, and with this one, there's so many angles. I mean, we didn't even talk about his ex-wife saying that she was in a very abusive marriage. And then there's new reporting out that he texted his current wife during the massacre. So these pieces are still being put together, and there's so many different angles. I mean, domestic violence is often the case when there's a shooter. There's a partner almost always involved.
Yeah.
And that's another angle we need to focus on. Sandeep, where should this story go from here?
I mean, right now, I think the story has been so covered from all angles, it's hard to tell. You know, at a certain level, I don't really want to know more about this story. Obviously, there is a kind of vicarious level where you are curious about what you can find out about the actual motivation, because you want to understand what happened. But I think the unfortunate thing is where the story is going, which I don't prove, which is, how do you prevent this from happening again? You know, how do you prevent Hillary Clinton saying, I will focus more on the lone wolf shooter? And in the end, you have to realize that's, you know, some of these, you know, if somebody takes guns and walks into, whether it's a gay club or a supermarket, they are going to be able to wreak mayhem. You know, this is a fact of the kind of society that we live in and the liberties that we want to enjoy. So let us, you know, we have to understand it, but we can't necessarily say we'll prevent it.
Sandeep Roy is a commentator on NPR and KALW. His debut novel is Don't Let Him Know. Mark Stern covers the law and LGBTQ issues for Slate. Sandeep and Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, Loretta Ross joins us to discuss the book Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Rights. The book retrieves the often forgotten history of reproductive rights organizations formed by women of color in the 80s and 90s. Loretta Ross, co-founder of Sister Song, helped coin the term reproductive justice. So how have women of color pushed the pro-choice movement to organize for a full spectrum of reproductive rights? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.